So if you remember back a couple of weeks ago, I said we were going to speak on marriage once again. And the question we were going to answer was this: who had the worst marriage in the Bible? And we're going to answer the question, who had the best marriage in the Bible? Who had the worst marriage in the Bible? And who had the best marriage in the Bible? Now, those are rhetorical questions, and in a different context, we could have some discussion, but in the sermon, we're not going to. So anyway, some of you may have some opinions about who had the best marriage, and some of you may have some opinions about who had the worst marriage. But I think you'll see that these two examples may fit that criteria. So let's look at the worst marriage first. Let's go to Judges chapter 14. Judges chapter 14. So this particular story unfolds in the period of the judges and involves one of the judges. Judges chapter 14, verse 1. Judges chapter 14, verse 1. It says, "Now Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines." So this Samson went down and he saw this girl that appealed to his eye. She appealed to his eye. She appealed to his carnal desires, and she seemed to be the perfect fit for what he desired. And so he saw her and said, "I would like to have her as my wife." So he's going on sight alone. He doesn't know this girl all that well. So he said, "She looks good to me, and I'd like to marry her." So I would say that living in the 21st century, that would fit with what is a common approach to marriage, and that is, she's hot. All right. So speaking in modern language, she was a good-looking woman. She was beautiful to his eye, and he said, "She's the girl for me." So then it says in verse 2, "So he went up and told his father and mother, saying, 'I have seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, get her for me as a wife.'" So his parents were going to be involved in the negotiations for his marrying this young lady. So he said, "Mom and Dad, this is the girl I want to marry. Please enter into negotiations for me in this regard." Then verse 3, it says, "Then his father and mother said to him, 'Is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren?'" I mean, there's nobody in our clan, nobody in our tribe, nobody in Israel. There's not one single person in Israel that you would have an interest in marrying. "So no woman among the daughters of your brethren or among my people, that you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines." And Samson said to his father, "Get her for me, for she pleases me well." So they ask a very important question: is she part of the nation of Israel? And he didn't care about that. That was not the criteria. He was looking at the fact that she pleased him well. But his parents are saying, you know, she's going to be of a different religion, and she's coming from a different perspective. And Samson really did not know the girl or her family. He didn't really know them. He was going on what he saw with his own two eyes, as opposed to really knowing the young lady. So what do we see taking place here? In the crudest sense, the marriage is based on physical lust and not on knowing her or her family. That was not important. Let's go to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 3. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, beginning in verse 3. And this particular scripture pertains to this situation, and it pertains to all marriages. It says in verse 3, it says, "For this is the will of God, your sanctification." It is God's will that you as God would become God's people. You would be set aside for His Holy Spirit, for His holy purpose, that His Spirit would dwell in you and guide you. You're set apart from the rest of the world. For this is the will of God, your sanctification. And that was God's will back in Samson's time. That's what God wanted for Samson, that he would be sanctified. He was a part of the nation of Israel, God's people. So it was his desire that he would be sanctified, and that's still his desire, that you should abstain from sexual immorality. You are my people. Do not become involved in sexual immorality. You have that strong temptation, but don't give in to it. Stay away from it. You are to abstain from sexual immorality. Do not. As God's people, there is no justification for it. And he gives you instructions in order to how to avoid getting in trouble in that particular area. Verse 4, that each of you should know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor. So you are to live a certain way. How do you possess your own vessel in sanctification and honor? You realize, I am one of God's people. I have been set apart by God for His special purpose, to be an example to the world, to live in a way that is in harmony with God and with my fellow man. We've been sanctified. And there's a certain approach that he says we must take in order to remain in that condition. And he says, if you as are a young person, to flee sexual immorality. Flee it. So if you find yourself in a compromising situation, don't go there. Don't stay there. And don't put yourself in compromising situations. Like we are to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor, not in passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God. So people that don't know God, people that are living just by their eyes and their feelings and desires, they don't understand this. This is not an important thing to them. But we know better, and so this is important. This is not some mild or... This is a very important issue with God, and He's trying to point them in the right direction. And He was pointing them in that direction even in the time of the judges. But you also remember in the time of the judges, there was no king in Israel. There was no king in Israel. It wasn't because there was no king available. God was to be their king, but He wasn't. And it said, every man did that which is right in his own eyes. And as you look at the world in which we live today, it's a very similar world. So we're not to be just following our lusts and our desires, whether they're by what we see or what we desire. We're to live differently. Let's go to 1 John chapter 2. The people who went to camp, the young people who went to camp, are probably saying, man, he did this at camp. Why are we doing it again? Well, that goes back to the fact that you teenagers need to hear it more than once. But anyway, we all do. That's why God repeats things. God repeats things in order that we would be reminded and take to heart those things that we hear. Well, so 1 John chapter 2, verse 15 says, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. So it's not that we don't enjoy the world. It's not that we are not part of the world, but he says we're not to put it first. We're not to put it before God. Do not love the world or the things in the world. Don't put anything in the world. Don't make your love for whatever it may be such that you put it before God. God at all times must be first. In the way that we live, in the way that we enjoy the world, we enjoy it based upon God being first and foremost in our lives. We don't let the world take over and lead us and guide us. It says here, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. Don't let the world dictate the way you're going to live. Don't just follow your feelings, your desires, the things that you see and the things that you want. It says, and the world is passing away in the lust of it, but he who does the will of God abides forever. All of those things that we lust for and desire and covet, all of those things are going to go away. But there are things that are going to last, certain values and certain approaches that we have. It's important to have this perspective in order that we can approach things rightly. So, you know, if we're thinking about a marriage, it should not be based upon physical lust. And it's also important that we would know the girl or the guy that we are marrying and his or her family. That's an important criteria. Then, the second thing we have to realize is this, that as you remember in verses 1 through 3, the parents weren't for the marriage. They were not pro these two getting married. They saw the dangers there, and they brought it up. You can't find a young lady from Israel. You can't find a young lady that believes the way that you do. And he said, I want her, and none of those things matter. But, you know, if your parents tell you are not in favor of the marriage, that's telling you something. They're seeing something that they feel is important for you to know and understand. So if you parents, not just because you don't like the way he parts his hair, or this is your baby and you don't want to give her up or him up, you know, look, God said to leave home, start your own household. So you're looking at more serious things than that. So it's a matter of you see some danger. You see some questions that come to your mind as you look at the situation. You're going to have difficulties in your marriage because of these particular attitudes or approaches or background. You've got to consider those things. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 1. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 1. And probably none of us, when we found the love of our lives, none of us want to hear our parents say, I don't think that's going to work out very well for you. We're probably not going to listen to that. You know, just knowing that when you find somebody that you think is right, you don't want to hear it, and you're not, all you see is the upside. You see no downside. All right, that's how it is. Yes, but, no. You don't know what you're talking about. This is going to be the greatest marriage of all time. Everybody feels that way, and nobody sees some of the danger signs. And if your parents are saying something, they're making a legitimate point, consider it. Like it says in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 1. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 1. It says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. If your parents are telling you something that is biblically accurate, And pointing out dangers, it says, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Because most parents, if they're going to have the guts to tell you straight out the problems they see, it's because they love you. It's because they want the best for you. We had an illustration at camp you can talk till you're blue in the face and you're talking to people that are rockheads and they're not going to listen. You can talk and talk and talk and talk. You know, we had counselors talking. We had me talking. We had our counselor head talking to them a third time. And didn't get it. So as soon as, you know, camp's over and breakfast is over, well, your time is yours. Boom, they were right together. So there's no, you're telling them, this is dangerous, don't do this. But what can you do? People are going to do what they want to do. It's good to listen to people that are trying to help you. And sometimes it's not a matter of you're not getting married. Sometimes it's a timing matter. When you're a young person, you may find what you think is the love of your life. And if you pursue this to its end, when you get to, you're at 17, let's say, and you're turned out, you get to about 21, 22, 23, you're going to look at the world differently because you've matured. And you find yourself, I'm stuck. What do I do? So sometimes if you're young and in love, it's wise to listen and give it time to develop. So anyway, in verse 2 it says, honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise. Why do that? Why listen to your parents? It's because your parents are fun killers. Your parents don't want you to have all the good things in life. They're trying to deprive you of the greatest opportunity you can have. I don't believe that's the case. The reason that you would listen is because of the promise. It says in verse 3, that it may be well with you, and you may live long on the earth. They're acting, they're telling you things that are going to be good for you, and that are going to help ensure that your marriage is going to be a lasting marriage. And it's good to listen. So the parents, in this particular case with Samson, they're not in favor of the marriage. And the woman was not an Israelite or of the people of Samson. And she was not willing to listen. And the scriptures very clearly tell you it's a good thing to listen. For instance, in Proverbs chapter 23, verse 22, you don't need to turn there, but I'll read it for you. It says, listen to your father who begot you. Listen to your father who begot you, and do not despise your mother when she is old. So you may consider them as old fogies. They don't know what they're talking about, but sometimes they see things you don't. And it is wise to listen to your parents. Third thing here. The girl was a Philistine, and the Philistines did not worship the God of Israel. They worshipped Dagon and other idols made of stone. And this is a serious issue to consider as you marry. Let's go to Genesis chapter 28. Genesis chapter 28. And look at a story here that involves Jacob. Jacob recognized the problem. Genesis chapter 28, beginning in verse 1. Genesis 28, verse 1. Then Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. This is a father speaking to his son out of concern for the son. And he did not want his son to take a daughter of the people of the land of Canaan. Why not? They didn't have any good-looking girls in Canaan? Absolutely they did. But he said, I don't want you to marry a young lady from the land of Canaan. Because they worship false gods. They're involved in idolatry. They're involved in various things that are wrong. And I don't want you to marry her. This is not just advice for people living back in the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is good advice now. This is good advice now. So he did not want them to marry the daughters of Canaan. And he said in verse 2, arise, go to Paddan Aram, that is across the river, and that's the river Euphrates, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take yourself a wife from there of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. So travel there and marry one of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. Now why? Why did he want him to go up to Bethuel's house and marry one of those daughters? It had nothing to do with how good looking they were. It had to do with their religious beliefs. I want you to go up there and marry a young lady from there because they believe the same as you do. He says in verse 3, may God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you that you may be an assembly of peoples and give you the blessing of Abraham to you and your descendants with you that you may inherit the land in which you are a stranger, which God gave to Abraham. So Isaac sent Jacob away. And he went to Paddan Aram to Laban, the son of Bethuel, the Syrian, the brother of Rebekah, the mother of Jacob and Esau. So they went up there he was sent up there to find a young lady to marry from that area, not to marry a Canaanite. So that's Jacob. But what about Esau? Let's look at Esau. Esau, continuing on here in verse 6. Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Paddan Aram to take himself a wife from there. And that as he blessed him, he gave him a charge saying, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan." He understood that. And who had married of the daughters of Canaan? Esau had. Esau had already married of the daughters of Canaan. His parents saw it and said, "We do not want Jacob to do that." And that Jacob had obeyed his father and his mother and had gone to Paddan Aram. Also Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan did not please his father Isaac. So Esau went to Ishmael and took Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, and the sister of Nebajoth, to be his wife in addition to the wives he had. He married of the daughters of Canaan. Now, he married another lady here, so we have him practicing polygamy, and Jacob did the same thing. But Jacob made the long trip up to where his family was from in order to find a young lady to marry who was from that same religious background. And that is an important thing. You have to realize that if being one of God's people and following God's ways is important to you, when you marry somebody out of the church, you make your life more difficult. They don't know the truth. That's not important to them. And they may be fine people in many ways, but you will never have that area of religion in which you can be in harmony. You both, you know, my wife and I traveling down here today from Marshall, we were able to listen to a sermon, and my wife comes in and said, "You know, I listened to this today and it's really good," or "I read this today," and we can discuss those kind of things. We can both rejoice together in the feast. You have a religious harmony, something that you have in common that you may not have if you marry outside the church. And that was it. This was important in the time of Jacob and Abraham, as we'll see, and it's still important. What did God tell the people of Israel? Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 1 through 5. Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 through 5. So this was God's instruction to the nation of Israel. And he says, "When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess, and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites and all of the other ites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them. Nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughters to their son, nor take their daughters for your son." He says, "For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods, so the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly." So he's saying, marry people of like mind, people that agree with you religiously, people with whom you can be in harmony religiously. It's an important aspect of a marriage. And he said, because it's, you know, if the best you're going to get is neutrality. They're not causing any problems. They're happy to go along with you, but they're not going to be on the same page with you in all probability. They have to work on the Sabbath. They may work on the Sabbath. You know, if they want to celebrate Christmas, you may be celebrating, have the tree in your house or whatever. It's going to make life more challenging. And that's why he says, don't do it. And, you know, as you're butting up against somebody that is not of the same faith, you keep butting up against them, and it eventually gets old. It gets old, and it becomes easier to compromise. We'll see an example here momentarily that helps to illustrate that. So anyway, you are to, marry somebody of the faith. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 11. 1 Kings chapter 11, and we look at an example here where there's a failure to heed that instruction. Let's look at 1 Kings 11, beginning in verse 1. "1 First Kings 11, verse 1. But King Solomon loved many foreign women. So he didn't just have one wife. He had lots of wives and concubines. As well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites, from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. I mean, when you have that many ladies that you're married to or involved with, it's pretty hard to be influenced by them. I mean, you're looking at kind of a tsunami coming at you. How do you stay on track? For it was so, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. And Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord, as did his father David. So they can turn your hearts away. And you put yourself in a situation where you're open to that possibility. And that's something that is very common in the church today, because there's nobody to marry. There's nobody to date, much less marry. So we have no choice. And it is a hard thing. It's not easy. You know, I was blessed to go to Ambassador College, and there were lots of young ladies there to marry. But you know what? There were lots of people that went through Ambassador College with that whole pool of eligible individuals, and they came out on the other side of that without a mate. So there's no insurance, even if there's a big pool there, that you'll find somebody in the church. But if you pursue it in the right way, God says He will watch out for you and provide for you. Let's go to 2 Corinthians. This is something that Paul understood and looked at as an apostle in the church. And he says some important things to us, and they're very much applicable to the church. And the reason he makes these statements is because of what it says in the Old Testament. Things did not change between the old and the new in this particular regard. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 17. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 17. It says here in verses 17 and 18, therefore come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. And you know, if somebody does not believe the way that we do, they're different from you. And he says to be separate and don't join together as husband and wife. And he speaks to this more specifically in chapter 6, beginning in verse 14. He says, do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. And so you can be yoked in a business. And if you are in business with somebody not in the church, their approach to business can be very different from what a Christian should be doing. And that makes business hard when there's that level of disagreement. They don't have any trouble with lying where you see that that's not right, or maybe cutting corners on business. And when you see that that's not appropriate for a Christian, what do you do? If you're yoked to them, you don't have much choice. And a yoking is a marriage. When you marry, you are yoked together. So you and the person that you've chosen to marry are yoked together. If you're in harmony as you're yoked together on various aspects of life, and importantly, most importantly, you're in harmony religiously, it makes it easier. You're pulling together. You're working together. You're cooperating together in order for your family to be a success. So he says, don't be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? You know, you're trying to be righteous, and that may not be important to them. And what communion has light with darkness? And what accord has Christ with Belial? Or what part has a believer with an unbeliever? So yoking yourself together is a serious thing, because once you're yoked, And if you are in harmony religiously, it does make a great deal of difference. Let's go back to to Judges and look at Samson. Let's look at Samson in Judges chapter 14, verse 5. So, you see that Samson is bound and determined to marry this lady from Timnah. And so let's see how this works out. Judges chapter 14, verse 5, it says, "So Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother and came to the vineyards of Timnah. Now, to his surprise, a young lion came roaring against him." So this lion attacks him, and he kills the lion. You know, God empowers him through his spirit, and it says that he tore it apart just like one would tear apart a goat. I don't know whether it's a live goat or whatever, but he just basically tore it apart and killed the lion. And verse 7, "Then he went down and talked with the woman, and she pleased Samson well. After some time, when he had returned to get her, he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion, and he finds this lion, this roaring, powerful lion, with a beehive growing in it, that has been established in it, and honey dripping from it. And so he took some of the honey and he ate it and gave some to his mother and father. And then verse 10, "So his father went down to the woman, and Samson gave a feast there for young men used to do so." So he's entering into this relationship. His father has negotiated it, and they're having this party, this wedding party. And So then Samson gave a feast for the young men used to, as they did at that time. And it happened when they saw him, and they brought 30 companions to be with him. And so Samson poses this riddle to them. And so they agree to the riddle. So he poses the riddle to them. And he said that, you know, if you guys cannot solve the riddle in a certain amount of time, then you're going to give me clothing, and which was a very expensive thing at the time. And he says, "If you cannot explain it to me, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing." And so they said, "Pose your riddle." And the riddle is, "Out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet." Now for 3 days they could not explain the riddle. So they came up with a solution to what the riddle was. They said, "We will put some pressure on Samson's wife." So they did put pressure on his wife. And they said, basically, "You are tasked with getting the answer to the riddle. And if you don't do it, we will burn you out. We'll burn your house down, you, your father's house." And so she obviously was under pressure to get this information. So she began crying and putting pressure on Samson. And when the seventh day came around, Samson finally gave in and gave her the answer to the riddle. And she passed that information along to these men. They came up and explained the riddle. They said, "What is sweeter than honey, and what is stronger than a lion?" They solved it. But Samson knew that there was no way they could have solved it unless they had talked to his wife. And like he says in at the end of verse 18, he says, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle." So he went down and to Timnah, and he killed 30 Philistines and took their clothes and said, "Here you go." And then it says in verse 20, "And Samson's wife was given to his companion, who had been his best man." So when you look at the outcome of this particular relationship, his wife was dishonest. She lied to him, and her lack of character was obvious. And this whole situation ended badly. You know, if you find out that your spouse is lying to you, there's no greater blow than can happen to your marriage. It is hard to survive such a situation. But here, early on in the relationship, this takes place. So as you think about Samson, you can see his approach, and is an approach that many people throughout the ages have taken. Is that the approach you want to take? Or is there a better approach? Well, let's look at the best marriage in the Bible. Who had the best marriage recorded in the Bible? In Genesis chapter 24, we find one of the Bible's greatest love stories. A love story that's very hard for us to understand because in the 21st century, we would not even consider doing what took place here. We would not consider doing that. In Abraham's time, the wife who was barren lived in shame. You were expected to have children. And if you were a husband and you did not have children, it was a very hard thing to go through as a father. You're wanting to be a father and unable to do so. Abraham and Sarah had to wait a long time before Isaac was born. He was the child of promise, but it was a very difficult thing for them. Eventually, God fulfilled the promise, but they had to wait quite a while. Abraham saw clearly one great threat to future generations was the mingling with the Canaanite people who surrounded them. So he saw that that was the case. The Canaanites, as we've seen, were idol worshippers and given over to reprobate minds, practicing things that we see taking place in Sodom and Gomorrah. And he said, I don't want my son, my long-awaited son, to marry into the Canaanite culture. So Abraham's son, Isaac, was not yet married, and Isaac was very grieved by the loss of his mother. So he was not married at the time of his mother's death. And Abraham was afraid that because of the grieving and the very positive relationship that he had with his mother, that he would look to take comfort in marriage and would marry someone from the surrounding nation. So if Isaac married one of the local girls, she might lead their children into idolatry and perhaps even Isaac himself. And where would Israel be? There would be no Israel. It would have been aborted right off the bat. So Abraham knew he had to act fast. He needed to find a proper wife for Isaac, and the only way that that was going to happen was to rely on the Lord's guidance. It was not by might, it was not by strength, it was by God's Spirit that this was going to work out in a positive way. So let's go to Genesis chapter 24. Genesis chapter 24, beginning in verse 1. It says, Now Abraham was old, well advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. So Abraham said to the oldest servant of his house, who ruled over all that he had, Please put your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I dwell. I don't want you to take a wife for my son from the surrounding peoples. But you shall go to my country, to my family, and take a wife for my son Isaac. And the servant said to him, Perhaps the woman will not be willing to follow me to this land. Must I take your son back to the land from which you came? But Abraham said to him, Beware that you do not take my son back there. So for some reason he didn't want his son to go back to that land. The Lord God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my family, and who spoke to me and swore to me, saying, To your descendants I will give this land, he will send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there. Now, you know, that only happened in Abraham's time. That never happens today, does it? God's different today than he was then. Is that true? I don't think it is, because somewhere in there it says God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. God says, I change not. So he said that don't choose a wife for him of the Canaanites. And so the angel would go before him, verse 8, And if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be released from this oath. Only do not take my son back there. So the servant put his hand under his thigh, and he made the promise that he would fulfill it in the way that Abraham wanted him to do. Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed, for all his master's goods were in his hand. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. And he made his camels kneel down outside the city as by a well of water at evening time, the time when women go out to draw water. Then he said, O Lord God of my master Abraham, please give me success this day. and show kindness to my master Abraham. So God is very much involved in what's going on here. And Abraham's servant was a worshiper of the true God. Verse 14. He says, "Now let it be that the young woman to whom I say, 'Please let down your pitcher, and that I may drink,' and she says, 'Drink, and I will also give your camels a drink,' and let her be the one you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I will know that you have shown kindness to my master." So he asks for God's guidance, and then he, he's basically placing the matter in God's hands and asking that God would show him who the right person would be. "And it happened before he had finished speaking that, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, the daughter of the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, came out with her pitcher on her shoulder. Now the young woman was very beautiful to behold, a virgin. No man had known her, and she went down to the well, filled her pitcher, and came up. And the servant ran to meet her and said, 'Please let me drink a little water from your pitcher.' And she said, 'Drink, my lord.' Then she quickly let her pitcher down to her hand and gave him a drink. And when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, 'I will draw water for your camels also until they have finished drinking.'" So that's a pretty serious thing she's doing here, because carrying water is not easy. So she said, I'll water your camels as well. And so it says, now the young woman was, so let's go down to verse 18. So she said, "Drink, my lord," and then goes on and gives water to the camels. And as you think about those camels and her watering them, she tells us that she's a hard worker. Who's this guy? Why am I going to give water to his camels? Why am I going to help this person? As you think about it from a New Testament point of view, Christ said, "I will recognize you because you gave water to one of my servants." Remember that in Matthew chapter 25? She's practicing this. She's practicing it. And so she's not lazy. And the water for 10 camels would be about 60 gallons. About 60 gallons of water, and she carried the water in a clay pot on her shoulder. It may have taken as many as 20 trips. So she was working up a sweat doing this. The servant saw her beauty and also her character, and said this is a very, could see from what he was looking at there that she was a hard worker and had many good qualities that would make her a good wife. So let's go down to verse 21. Of chapter 24. "And the man, wondering at her, remained silent so as to know whether the Lord had made his journey prosperous or not. So it was when the camels had finished drinking that the man took a golden nose ring weighing half a shekel and two bracelets for her wrist weighing 10 shekels of gold and said, 'Whose daughter are you? Tell me, please, is there room in your father's house for us to lodge?' So she said to him, 'I am the daughter of Bethuel, Milcah's son, whom she bore to Nahor.' Moreover, she said to him, 'We have both straw and feed enough and room to lodge.' Then the man bowed down to his head and worshiped the Lord. And he said, 'Blessed be the Lord God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his mercy and his truth toward my master. As for me, being on the way, the Lord led me to the house of my master's brethren.' So the young woman ran and told her mother's household these things." So he sees that this is from God, and God is going to allow, this seems to be working out. Let's go down to verse 50, chapter 24, verse 50. It says here, "So Laban and Bethuel answered and said, 'The thing comes from the Lord.' So they're willing to agree to this marriage. 'We cannot speak to either bad or good. Here is Rebekah before you. Take her and go, and let her be your master's son's wife, as the Lord has spoken.'" So Rebekah, the family supported the marriage, and they were also, they said, we give our blessing on this. This is something that is important, that parents would be supportive of the marriage relationship that's being entered into. Let's go to chapter 24, beginning in verse 52. And it came to pass, when Abraham's servant heard these words, and he worshipped the Lord, bowing himself to the earth, then the servant brought out jewelry of silver, jewelry of gold, and clothing, and gave them to Rebekah. He also gave precious things to her brother and to her mother. The dad, Bethuel, didn't get anything. And he ate, and the men who were with him ate and drank and stayed all night. Then they arose in the morning, and he said, "Send me away to my master." But her brother and her mother said, "Let the young woman stay with us a few days, at least 10. After that she may go." And he said to them, "Do not hinder me, since the Lord has prospered my way and send me away so that I may go to my master." So they said, "We will call the young woman and ask her personally." Then they called Rebekah and said to her, "Will you go with this man?" And she said, "I will go." Think about that. Isaac and Rebekah had dated for years. They knew each other well. They knew everything about each other before they got married. She had never even seen Isaac. She didn't know much about him other than that they were of the same religion and from the same family background. That's all she knew. And she said, "I will go." Can you imagine such a thing? So she said she would go. And at this point, she's betrothed to Isaac legally. They're not married yet, but she is betrothed to him. And this is the same agreement that bound Mary to Joseph, and is a type of a Christian being bound to Jesus Christ, not having seen him yet, and yet living with him. So God tells us, so they are betrothed, and this is something that takes place for all of us. And as she travels across the burning sands of the Middle East there, let's go down to verse 63. Verse 63, "And Isaac went out to meditate in the field in the evening. And he lifted his eyes and looked, and there the camels were coming. Then Rebekah lifted her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from her camel. For she had said to the servant, 'Who is this man walking in the field to meet us?' The servant said, 'It is my master.' So she took a veil and covered herself." And why did she do that? The veil told everyone that she was betrothed to a husband and was not available. So she covered her face there with that veil. But obviously, before this, she was not covered with the veil. But as she came into contact with this man, she did cover her face. And verse 66, "And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death." So he brought her, he had a close relationship with his mom, and now he enters into this lifetime relationship with Rebekah. And notice that Isaac had that good relationship with his mom, and he enters into this marriage relationship with Rebekah. So how a person gets along with their family is a most important thing. If you find somebody and they're not getting along well with your family, then that should be a red flag for you. They should be able to get along with their family. It's an indication of what that husband or wife may be like. So some historical traditions record that Isaac and Rebekah had a very close marriage. He prayed for her to have children, and God did answer, and they had the twins. So let's think about the principles we've looked at as far as if you're thinking about getting married. First of all, this marriage that took place between Isaac and Rebekah was based on faith. Abraham, his servant, and Isaac and Rebekah acted in faith and asked God to guide their decisions. And it is my belief that if you think about this, and you think about Matthew chapter 6, verse 33, it says that seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. And I think that if that is your goal and you're putting God first, that God is involved there and God will in some way, shape or form provide for you. A second point, they both already worshiped the true God. They were of the same religion. They didn't have to convert each other or any of that kind of thing, or have separate religions. They were already on the same page. Also, you find here that the families were both in support. They were both in support. Isaac and Rebekah listened to their parents, and they were both supportive of the relationship and their being married together. Finally, both Isaac and Rebekah were people of character. They knew the true religion and they practiced it. You know, if you remember back to the sermon we covered about Isaac, Isaac was, you know, he was known, you know, it was the fear of Isaac. Isaac was known for his fear of God. So Isaac was a loyal, obedient, faithful, and hardworking man. And Rebekah was a loyal, obedient, faithful, and hardworking woman. They shared a belief in God, a common faith. And as you think about these things, it's the formula for a great marriage. So for young people, this is a good formula to follow. So as you think about Samson and you think about Isaac and Rebekah, which path would you prefer to follow? And for all of us, as we're thinking about, is this formula working in our marriage? So these are good lessons, wonderful lessons for us in regard to marriage. And I hope that we will all learn from them and take them to heart. So thanks for your attention. Please have a good, wonderful remainder of the Sabbath day. And next week we will have services and we will also have Bible study. So an hour after, about 20 minutes or so after services, we'll have a Bible study after the sermon next week.